Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of my program that I share with you is called World Watchers, and it is number 701, 701 broadcast. This is May the 13th, 1985. Last week, I went backwards instead of going to 700. You probably picked that up. It wasn't 670. It was program 700. So on your tape, if you have a microphone at home, press it down and change the number so people listening to the tape will know, or print on the outside, of course, correct the number. It might be corrected there for you already. But we want to keep these in the proper chronological order. Now, there was a lot of news on Bitburg, more that I'll be sharing with you this week, and more on the search for Joseph Mengele. The heat is on now. And the name Fritz Kramer came up in the Bay Area on San Francisco three times, once on a replay. But Fritz Kramer was unleashed into the proper news media on ABC Radio, large radio and station talk show in San Francisco, and we'll talk about that. The program that Jim Eason has in the afternoon from 1 to 4 had a gentleman, John Tolan, who's an authority on Nazi Germany, in quotes, authority. He also worked for a long time in Spain with Otto Skorzeny, I understand, and has an interesting connection with many of the existing Nazis today. He's written quite a few books on Nazi Germany, and he was a guest with Jim Eason on KGO, that's an ABC station, and somebody called in and asked him if he knew about Fritz Kramer. Now, I had been in the Bay Area several weeks ago handing out almost 100 sheets. I took up 200, but I preferred to speak individually to people there instead of just handing them out indiscriminately at the protests and the marches, the peace marches up there on the 20th of April. And I've also mentioned Fritz Kramer on Ray Taliaferro's show. I've called in late at night. So they asked John Tolan if he ever knew about Fritz Kramer. And his answer was, no, he'd never heard anything about Fritz Kramer. And the caller said that there was a man who was a mentor to Henry Kissinger who works in the United States of German extract. I believe he knew that much or said that. And the other one, Fritz Kramer, was Hitler's general. And then Tolan went on and made a real boo-boo. He said it's a very common name in Germany, just as Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, or Sirhan, Sirhan is in this country. But he said it's a very common name in Germany, and he never heard of it. And he was reminded by the person who called in that this man was tried at Nuremberg, which was an error, but it wasn't much of an error considering who he was talking to, because he was a defendant at the Dachau trials that were separated from Nuremberg, that were specifically the Malmendy Massacre and the Battle of the Bulge and the horrors that went on there. And John Tolan wrote a book over 300 pages on the Battle of the Bulge. In fact, his book, he writes about the Malmendy trial and leaves out the name of Fritz Kramer, who was very important to Adolf Hitler. So he said, no, he didn't know about him. He said, there is this mentor of Henry Kissinger is in this country, but he doesn't know anything about Adolf Hitler's Fritz Kramer. Now, after that program, later in the week, another person called up Jim Eason when it was open talk time. It wasn't on any specific subject. They have a free time, and he called in, and he wanted to clarify the question that was brought up in the air to John Tolan to make matters worse, Tolan saying he didn't know. This man had a foreign accent. He said he had studied at the London School of Economics, which was very much part of Kissinger's background, Henry Kissinger, and also Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker brought Fritz Kramer to this country, all three of them from Germany. But he called in, and he said he wanted to clarify it because he said, regarding that Kramer matter that came up during the week, I did some studying on that, and the mentor to Henry Kissinger came to the United States in 1938. So the listeners, this is a wide listening audience of 60 or 80,000 people every day. It's 24 hours more in the evening, and it carries better at night. But he said he came to the United States in 1938. What he didn't say was that the man wasn't glued to the United States once he came in. He wasn't kept here. And that I have sent to the Army for his papers, and I've shared that with you before, that the Kramer that came to the United States put on a uniform as a U.S. Army intelligence in the American Army, even though he was German, and that during the Battle of the Bulge, when he took Henry Kissinger to Europe in December of 44, and November and December of 44, and during the time period up till the end of the war of May 1945, Kissinger's mentor, the German Fritz Kramer, was in four or five different countries. I'd have to look that up again. Scotland, England, France, and Germany. So the fact that he came here in 1938 doesn't mean that he stayed here, because he was, in fact, in Germany, and he could have been arrested when our troops got there, because the dates that he was in Germany, our Pentagon will not reveal to us. And then the second point was that he brought out that Hitler's Fritz Kramer was in charge of the Panzer 6th Panzer Division, which was true. And he says he wasn't involved in the Battle of Bulge much, except for plans, which was true. He wasn't a soldier in the field. He's plans officer, and was to our Pentagon from 1948 until just recently, as late as 1975 or so. But he's a plans man. He isn't a battlefield man, but he was in the plans. And he said that he was a prisoner for 10 years. This person wanted to inform people on material that John Tolan said he didn't know about. Well, this Fritz Kramer was not in prison 10 years. He was out by 1948, and the trial was in 1946. So the assumption was wrong on one, the time that he was locked up, the second point was off. So therefore, he was adding more fuel to this particular fire and not solving anything. But at least, this is the first I've heard that the name Fritz Kramer has gotten out in this kind of form. And I've been on it for 2.5 years hoping that you people who hear my broadcast or subscribe to the tapes will use that talk show format, take the sheet you have that go with the broadcast, and become informed and call these radio people and talk about it and get that name circulating out there. I want to give an award to the person who did it. I don't know who did it, but finally somebody opened that up. Well, I got out John Tolan's book on the Battle of the Bulge, specifically on that. It was published by Signet in 1959. And there are four people that are important to the Malmedy massacre as defendants there, but they're important because of their links to Senator Joe McCarthy, and also because they team up later through one of the four, Otto Skorzeny, to form the Odessa, which is the world spy network against Jews for the eventual extermination of all Jews and the continuation of the policies of Nazism and these extermination policies. The men involved in the Battle of the Bulge, the four that worked together, that are in the docket together, that were with Adolf Hitler planning it, and they're together afterwards, one is Colonel General Joseph Dietrich, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H, like Marlene Dietrich. The other is Mr. Joachim, J-O-C-H-E-N, Piper, P-E-I-P-E-R. That was another officer, Lieutenant Colonel Joachim Piper. The third was Lieutenant Colonel Otto Skorzeny, S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y, and the fourth was Fritz Kramer. Now, in the Battle of the Bulge by Mr. John Tolan, he has about 20 pages indexed on Colonel Joseph Dietrich, Colonel General Joseph Dietrich. He has over 20 pages in the index on Lieutenant Colonel Otto Skorzeny. He's got about 30 pages in references to Lieutenant Colonel Joachim Piper, whose picture was in the newspapers throughout the country when the president said he was going to Bitburg. That was the staging area for these gentlemen for the 1st Panzer Division, and over Mr. Dietrich was Fritz Kramer. So John Tolan has a section on a whole book on the Battle of the Bulge, and he has a section on Malmedy, and very conveniently leaves out the name of Kramer, who he says is common like Smith, but he's sitting right there in the front row with prisoner number 33 identifying him. So you would think in a book on the Battle of the Bulge that he would at least be familiar with the name. Now, in his book on page 370 on the Malmedy trials, he says, this was written in 1959, many of the German survivors of the Bulge are now dead. Model committed suicide. Ronstedt died in an old folks' home near Weinhausen. That was von Ronstedt, who worked with the Polish division and near Krakow and Wadowice, and was in charge of sending the Ukrainians into the ovens from the Polish area. And then Hitler brought all these men to the front to be part of being rounded up by the Americans and the Germans who were in America to use them later. But he says that Ronstedt died in an old people's home, so he was not in prison, and Model was out free when he commits suicide, in quotes. Then he says that the Malmedy trial in Dachau in 1946, Piper was sentenced to hanging and Dietrich to life imprisonment. And he says 42 defendants were sentenced to be hanged. That was pretty strict, considering that our president of the United States is at the staging area saying that these were all innocent young men and the survivors, 42 were to be hanged and 23 to get life in prison. And he says that Piper was to hang. Dietrich would never get out. And then he tells about Colonel Willis M. Everett, Jr. of Atlanta, Georgia, who was sent by the United States government and Senator Joe McCarthy and even put in $40,000 of his own money because of his efforts. This is what Mr. Tolan writes, because of the efforts of Colonel Everett, Dietrich and Piper were freed and now live under probation near Stuttgart. Well, what I shared with you last week was the fact that Mr. Dietrich went on with Hans Ulrich Rudel and Otto Skorzeny down to South America to set up the World Nazi Organization. Piper was living in France. They were not under any kind of probation. And the name that's left out of this whole section on the trial and in the book happens to be Fritz Kramer. That's why it's so hard to smoke out this guy. And we have to get his name known because these historians are lying and leaving it out and making him a non-person for the history books. He went on in this book, Skorzeny lives in Madrid, under a different, he gives his passport, his alias, and he hopes someday to come to the United States to teach his commando tactics. Now, Hans Ulrich Rudel and Otto Skorzeny were part of the links to Mr. Erlinger up in Buffalo, who meets with Richard Butler in Idaho, the engineer from Lockheed that worked at Lockheed when then Caesar was there and Robert Kennedy was killed, worked with Reverend Gale, Lieutenant Colonel Reverend Gale with the Identity Movement, and the Nazi movement that is in the news just this past week with their computers over the states identifying people that should be killed in the future, the Jews to be hung from the lamppost and have their throats cut. They fit right to this group, and Don Tolan is out there preaching the fact that he's the authority on Nazism and is one of the great artists at covering up the whole event. Now, I got his book. I have his two-volume book on Adolf Hitler. It's got only 1,073 pages. And again, in the story of Adolf Hitler and Nazism, he has Mr. Dietrich, Mr. Piper, Mr. Skorzeny, but you go to page 1089 in the index, and there's no Fritz Kramer. He doesn't exist in the life of Mr. Tolan, John Tolan. But he does have some interesting pictures in his book on the Battle of the Bulge, and one of them is Maxwell Taylor. Well, Maxwell Taylor not only was important to the Battle of the Bulge with William Donovan and William Casey, but he was important to our horrible events that were so outrageous in Southeast Asia with the Agent Orange, with the Phoenix Program, the killing of about 2 million Vietnamese, the decimation of the land. Then Taylor was just meeting this February in the Pentagon with the Defense Department with John Singlaub and Mr. Adelhold, both retired officers of the military who linked directly to the Waffen-SS through the World Anti-Communist League and other organizations in 1985. Their history of counterinsurgency, of Nazi tactics, of working with the Nazis, was signed and sealed in this Battle of the Bulge area. And these men went on to have important jobs later that have influenced this country to where it became like Nazi Germany. As a matter of fact, as an epilogue in the book by John Tolan on the Battle of the Bulge, he said many of the Allied participants went on to greater fame. Eisenhower became president of the United States. Montgomery was the chief of SHAPE, that was the entire Army Organization Group. Bruce Clark, commander of the 7th Army in West Germany. Maxwell Taylor became chief of staff of the Army. James Gavin, the public conscience of the Army. And he runs down some very important people from the Bulge, and I have about 30 or 40 more. Prince Bernhard, who formed the Bilderbergers, and so forth. Now, I have shared this with you before, but because it's so crucial to the Bitburg story and to the way history lies, and I have to illustrate this for new listeners, and sometimes I have to repeat these stories to prove a certain point. I just want to bring out a few sentences and references to the fact that Fritz Kramer did, in fact, exist. It is history that he was prisoner 33. You just don't end up in the dockets where a whole group of men are getting life sentences and are supposed to be hung for having done no ill deeds. The book The Damned Engineers by Janice Giles, this was published in 1970 by Houghton Mifflin, has a section on the 1st Panzer Corps. This was their staging area at Bitburg and their importance to Hitler, and goes on about Kramer and Dietrich and Piper and Skorzeny. I'll just cite a few pages. One quotation: if Hitler had rested his highest hopes on the 6th Panzer Army, and that was The plans of it were supposedly done by Fritz Kramer. Mr. Dietrich had his hopes on the 1st SS Panzer Division. In the top sector of the 1st Panzer Corps, the 1st SS was the 12th SS Panzer Division, which was Hitler's favorite. The 1st Panzer Division was called the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler, commanded by SS General Wilhelm Mohnke, M-O-H-N-K-E. I gave his name before because he left this important area, the Battle of the Bulge, where all his boys were in the hands of Americans, and then went to the German bunker with Adolf Hitler and Martin Bormann and the top Nazis that would fly down to Antarctica and South America later. He double-dipped into the two areas. This book goes on. The Liebstandarte Division had its proud origin in the elite original bodyguard unit with its cracked armored regiment. The 1st Panzer Regiment was also the Death's Head unit. The Death's Head began as concentration camp guards in 1940. They chose the youngest and the best of these men. That they were taken out and put into military units from the concentration camps. The 1st SS Regiment was therefore not only Liebstandarte, but Totenkopf, T-O-T-E-N-K-O-P-F, and their insignia was the Death's Head. Piper was working on page 121. It tells about Piper working with Mr. Dietrich, and they deduced where the offensives would be near the Ardennes, and he was to have a key role when General Kramer, the chief of staff of the 6th Panzer Army, asked him about his offensive through the Eifel and how long it would take the regiments to travel. So Kramer is there at that scene as an advisor, but at the end of the war, nowhere do I find any books about him in the divisions that were in Poland or Czechoslovakia or Hungary or France or Holland or Belgium. He was in America at that time. On page 108 and 109, it tells about the allegiance of the 6th Panzer Division. That was Fritz Kramer, and it refers to details of the plans and operations of Brigadier Führer der Waffen SS Fritz Kramer, operation of the 6th Panzer Army at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and I had sent for those papers. And it tells about how Hitler called in his favorite people for the ending of the war, or the winding down there from the 6th and 1st Panzer Division. And he, except Dietrich, was his favorite, his old friend. They fought together in World War I. He was a faithful follower of the Führer. And along with him, he was Chief of Staff General Fritz Kramer. Although their goal was Antwerp, and they understood to achieve it, Kramer had an excellent encirclement of Liège, and Piper and Kramer were, along with Adolf Hitler, and were called in simultaneously with their friend Otto Skorzeny, who would meet and work with them after the war. And also, Henry Kissinger was taken from the Haylofts to the castle in Germany with Kramer and Skorzeny and Klaus Barbie and the Nazis who had formed the Odessa later. Just finally, in the book Hitler's Last Gamble, it tells about General Kramer, the chief of staff, who was present throughout all the interviews with the army commander, and how he spent his time listening to plans for the war with Sepp Dietrich. And on page 111 of the same book, it tells about the role of Fritz Kramer and Sepp Dietrich and the psychological warfare and their planned entry into France. So just citing two books, Hitler's Last Gamble and The Damned Engineers, these men were very sick during the war, the last stages where they were rounded up by the Americans, and that's the important point, and Mr. Tolan had not heard of them. Now, it's very important that you call stations and keep this on the air and keep bringing it out. Now, why is Fritz Kramer so important? Why do I talk about him so much? He shares the offices, and I've given you the address, and I put on the letter to the president and the foreign news media. Now I have to get out to more people in the American media. He shares offices in Washington, D.C. with Daniel Graham. One area of Daniel Graham and his influence was Star War and Edward Teller and the hydrogen bomb. Those key connections are very important. And also, Fritz Kramer is the mentor to Henry Kissinger, who makes our policies in Southeast Asia, Middle East, Central America, South Africa. Henry Kissinger is their roving ambassador. Now, last week, there was an article, May 3rd, 1985, in the Washington Post, Private Groups Step Up Aid to Contras. You might have read that Reverend Moon is editor, Mr. Arnaud de Borchgrave, the great agent provocateur in the Pope shooting, trying to blame the KGB when Aja worked with Frank Turpel in the CIA. He's the editor of that paper. This is a different article on private groups, Step Up Aid. And the kingpin of those groups is the same John Singlaub that I've been trying to put on the air, but I haven't done enough time to do justice to the John Singlaub and his various connections to the far right wing. But in this one article, it tells about Singlaub working with the NDR, the Contras, in Nicaragua. When Congress says you can't have money for these atrocities, then Singlaub and his organization, which is the government behind our government, and it's not invisible any longer, says, well, here's $10 million. 40% of that was for arms. He also is associated with AmeriCares. I've briefly touched that. And they recently gave $14 million. He's part of the Knights of Malta from the Vatican, and they gave $20 million to the Contras. The World Anti-Communist League sent $2 million with arms coming from Argentina and Brazil and various fascist countries. That while the president in there has changed in Argentina and Bolivia to be a democracy, it's a very thin democracy and could fall flat, and they're still continuing squeezing out from the private groups, just as we're supposed to be a democracy, and the Congress says, don't send it. We have people that are arming the Contras, and that's happening in those countries. He's also president of the World Anti-Communist League, the international group that I talked about, and the greetings that the president sent in San Diego in September to their convention. And he's head of the United States Council on World Freedom, USCWF. Now, on the board of the United States Council of World Freedom is Daniel Graham, who shares those offices with Fritz Kramer. And he also, they get money from Joseph Kurz. They get a large hunk of money from Texas oil money. And they originally started this organization in 1981 with $20,000 from Taiwan and the family of Chiang Kai-shek. So wherever you go, that one of these tentacles is going to prong in to Daniel Graham and Fritz Kramer. They also mentioned in this Washington Post story that Singlaub is on the board of Western Goals. The late Larry McDonald was head up. On Western Goals is Edward Teller, and it was set up by Mr. Milliken of the Knights of Malta and J. Peter Grace. The money originally went into Western Goals and funds John Reese, who was seen publicly and lecturing with Daniel Graham. And in California, Ed Davis, the former chief of police, when he covered up the murder of Robert Kennedy and protected Thane Caesar, who works with Richard Butler, the Lockheed engineer who's the head of the Aryan Nations, he is the West Coast representative for Star Wars for Daniel Graham. So these names that I have been pulling out, and I've been accused often of using too many names, appear and reappear and reappear, so you're not going to have too much trouble just looking at the names. Now, if you are loyal and follow these programs every week, you can suddenly, if you didn't see it before, the overlapping of these people helping each other. This Washington Post goes into the fact that Reverend Moon puts money into helping fight the Contras. We know he does through a group called CAUSA. And it even mentions that the Japanese chapter of the World Anti-Communist League was founded in 1960 by Ryosha Sasakawa, a wealthy conservative businessman who heads Japanese shipbuilding. It's called Shipbuilding Industry Foundation. He was jailed as a Class A war criminal after World War II and then started to fund the Unification Church, a menace to the United States, a menace to freedom, linked to Mussolini, Franco, Hitler, the Japanese mafia. Reverend Moon's newspaper is now has DeBorsch Grave as the top editor, and they overlap very nicely to become a small family of people that have taken away the positions that our Congress has on whether it's decent or moral to allow the torture and murdering that's going on now in the name of anti-communism. Now, there was a story this last week that I briefly mentioned before it became a big story. And as far as I know, the tragedy of this particular item that I'm going to share with you is the way it's been suppressed in the newspapers around the country. As of today, I haven't seen any headlines or stories or even a small print from around the country on this matter. I mentioned a few weeks ago that Bill Graham, the music promoter, the rock promoter, was having a concert to express his anger against Ronald Reagan and is going to Bitburg. And he opened up, at least for the first time for the public, maybe people knew it and I didn't know it, that his mother and sister had been killed in concentration camps. And he paid $11,000 for an ad in the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle saying, don't go to Bitburg. And there was a demonstration in San Francisco at the Union Square. There was a rally, and one woman carried a picture of Ronald Reagan with a mustache with a swastika behind him and a swastika on his two collars. And there was various speakers there. Senator Milton Marks was there. It was a three-hour rally, and members of the Board of Supervisors from San Francisco, and he was objecting the president going. And when I heard that he spent $11,000 in there, and I'm scraping together some money for postage stamps on the president and the scandal of his being with Richard von Weizsäcker and going to Bitburg, where I understand the full history and the symbolism of what he's doing, I called the office and said, you know, if Bill Graham wants information on Reagan and Bitburg, why doesn't he come down here? I'll share it with him. And I also wrote a long letter sending a lot of printed material to him. He left for Europe right after that demonstration, and I left the next day to go to Los Angeles and didn't get back till Monday night to do my broadcast. And Tuesday or Monday at 3 in the morning, the entire Bill Graham warehouse offices just south of Marcus Street were burned to the ground. Now, a lot of you don't follow rock music. Some of you know a few of the musicians by name, but you don't know the climate that he produced in San Francisco. Bill Graham's art form became as much American art form, I believe, as the light opera and jazz and American quilts. It definitely changed the whole fabric of America, the feelings of the youth, the getting together of the rock musicians. It brought all the wrath of the COINTEL program down and the complete decimation and drugging and killing of the rock musicians. That was the Reagan-Edwin Meese administration out here in California, cracking them on their skull wherever they could. Now, to burn a museum, it was filled with all kinds of pictures and mementos of everything he had of that era, is a terrible tragedy. You may not feel it if you weren't part of that milieu and are not sympathetic to the music scene. But many of you who've listened for a long time know that I have continuously studied the scene of the musicians and have been always sensitive to their performances. Every single we got for the family, every single performance, the Monterey Pop, and went up north to see the Beatles. That was their last concert at Candlestick Park when they gave their very last. We didn't know it was their last, but we had enough good sense to take the children up there to see it, and up to see Bob Dylan in San Jose, and everywhere that we could, we went as a family, and I continued the interest after that, and they have been interested in music, and the rock music scene went more to Ticketron and commercial, so there was a sharp break after the COINTEL program began closing it down. But the one story in the San Francisco Examiner, April 27th, no Bitburg Reagan told at Union Square rally. Well, what happened after the Union Square rally? As I say, one week later, the newspapers had accounts that read like this. Graham headquarter fire called arson, motive unknown. And then it tells about things that went up in smoke, his belongings. He had autographed photos from John Belushi, the Grateful Dead, the Rolling Stones, The Who, Janis Joplin, all over the office. They were destroyed. Also, the first accounts of the Graham fire, I heard the morning news, they said Graham fire on the air, more details at 11:30, and I thought, holy mackerel, it can't be Bill Graham, but of course it would be. And the very first news said that somebody called around 3 in the morning, there were two people in San Francisco with Nazi uniforms that were seen in front of his building on Howard Street, and then later somebody called in and said that the Nazis, they took credit for this particular fire, but these mementos going down. Nothing about Nazi uniforms later. News stories followed, like May the 8th, San Francisco Rock Impresario's office is burned. $1 million fire destroys memorabilia and details of what he lost in this terrible fire. Arson suspected, 4-alarm blade, Bill Graham's office is outed. Graham's new office gets treasures that survived the fire. And this tells that one of the things that burnt was the only picture he had of his parents who were killed in Nazi Germany. And interestingly enough, the show that he was presenting, he still promotes musical shows. The show went on the next evening, even though the buildings had burned down, at the Warfield Theater on Tuesday night, 3 a.m. is the fire. It was business as usual for the Graham outfit, which presented a concert by Julian Lennon. If you want to choose your symbols carefully, as Helmut Kohl's aide said, you have one where the entire Graham memorabilia is burned down, and that next evening he's presenting Julian Lennon, and if you haven't heard him, he is really an echo of the past. You can get goose pimples thinking of John Lennon. He sounds so much like him. And Bill Graham was quoted in the newspaper as saying, Reagan is a despicable, inhuman creature. And of the Bitburg visit, he said, I'll despise him for it until the day I die. We'll take a one-minute break, and then I just want to do a little bit more on the rock musicians and Ronald Reagan and the things that I had been saying about him as he moved up to become president from 1979 on. And the handwriting was on the walls. I should have had the help of these people or the understanding to stop Reagan before it got so far.